Welcome to Your Wealth Mastermind with host Patricia Rivera and Diana McRae. Building a wealthy mindset in all areas of your life is crucial to your everyday success. Our topics focus on health, wealth, beauty, business, relationships, and inner spirituality. These all help to build the best and most powerful version of yourself. So let's get ready and go to the next level.
So everyone, welcome to another episode of Your Wealth Mastermind. My name is Diana McRae, and hi Patricia.
Hi Diana.
And on today's episode, we're going to talk about the importance of mental health care for women. To me, this is an extremely important topic for all women. And today, our focus, however, is on how to stay mentally healthy as women business owners. We have a very, very special guest. Her name is Asha Tari, and she is the CEO of Behavioral Health Consulting Services. So I'm going to read a little bit about her bio, and then we're going to get right into it. So Asha Tari is a certified life coach and licensed psychotherapist. As a treating provider, Asha has the expertise and skill to transform lives. The work she provides as a life coach for individuals, couples, groups, and small business entrepreneurs is based on the philosophy that we all need each other to grow and develop as human beings. As a psychotherapist, Asha has provided counseling to hundreds of clients with challenges in several areas of their lives. She has been called upon to discuss mental health issues to both small and large audiences as an expert on health panels, a guest on national radio broadcasts, and as a writer and consultant for publication and special projects, including films. Hi, Asha, and welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, we're excited to have you. So we're just going to get started with the questions. You know, and I'm so happy that you're on the show today because this to me and Diana is such a serious topic. You have the following statistics for mental illness on your website. 57 million people are diagnosed with mental illness. 14 million suffer from depression. It said 14 million are receiving treatment. Why do you think so many are not receiving treatment? And what percentage do you think are women?
Well, those stats continue to change. And depending on where you look, you might see different reports. We put those up on our website several years ago when I launched our mental health component. And depending on where you go, you might even see numbers are decreasing. So I would say in terms of mental illness, right, most people hear of two basic mental illnesses, depression and anxiety. But there's a whole host of others that you often don't hear about when it comes to personality disorders or even other mood disorders, for example. And so when I think about your question in terms of, you know, why are so many not receiving treatment, it's almost as if that question is leaned towards people that we would assume one could afford mental health treatment. And that's a barrier to a lot of people in certain areas not being able to receive help if they are unable to provide for themselves financially, if they don't have insurance or
insurance
provider that actually covers mental health treatment. And then if you think about what treatment is, it's a variety of types of treatment. So if working professionals, as an example, are insured or able to pay out of pocket, those people might be in a better position to actually seek help. They might have a higher education, more knowledge about mental health, and so they might have less stigma associated with actually asking for professional help. But if we think about other types of treatment, such as counseling from your minister or pastor, that's a form of treatment. Being in rehabilitation, that's another form of treatment. So there's different types of mental health care. Most people think of one-to-one therapist to client, but I think when we talk about those barriers, it's because of location, finances, education, and the ability to see mental illness not as a weakness, but as a biochemical disease that requires necessary professional attention we're rendered.
Very interesting.
Is there any percentage that you think a woman, or it just varies? Like,
one, I believe that's hard to guess. Mm-hmm. More than often, we do see as mental health providers women in treatment more than we see men. There is also an increasing need for adolescents and children to be treated. But in terms of even in my scope of work with my colleagues, I would say a majority of people who seek out healthcare and seek out mental health treatment are women. In terms of the percentage, I'm not exactly sure. I would say probably more than not, you're going to see more women in care than you are going to see men.
Wow.
Depends on the scope of work. You might have men who, based off of history, could end up more in rehabilitation centers for substance abuse, and you would see women who might end up in more one-on-one private practice care than you would see men. So depending on the scope or type of care, I think it would vary based on gender. Mm-hmm. I think it's changed a lot over the years depending on demographic.
So, you know, I read an article from a woman, a brave, courageous woman who, she was a CEO, and she, you know, she said that at one point, you know, she suffered from severe depression, and she actually wanted to commit suicide. So I honored the fact that she even wanted to share this. But then she decided to get help, you know, and she's doing really well right now. I mean, she gave, like, this great experience. But I think there's two things that I think about is how do we, you know, recognize when we need help? And then when we do, what steps are you recommending in getting help that you need?
First, that's a story of success because, one, so many women actually passively attempt suicide. And the reason why I use the word passively is women tend to take measures that don't often lead to a completion of suicide. So, for example, women tend to take pills, over-the-counter drugs, or even prescribed medications to go to sleep in hopes that if they are actually looking to complete suicide, they would die. That doesn't often happen. Women will also do things that would lead someone to possibly hurt or harm them. So even a depressed individual subsequently ending in a domestic violence situation where harm is definitely, you know, a part of the relationship. That could be a passive form of someone attempting to hurt themselves. Whereas men take more aggressive steps. Men, if they are thinking seriously about completing suicide, they're either going to die by hanging or by shooting themselves.
Wow.
Or jumping off bridges. And you hear those stories more often with professional people who are at risk of losing it all financially, jumping off of bridges, walking into traffic. So those are the differences when it comes to how men and women actually achieve suicide differently. What I would say in terms of the steps, which aren't as drastic as those, would be, one, looking at how you're sleeping at night. If you notice that you have days or weeks upon weeks where your sleep is interrupted and there's no medical reason for that, there's no change in your health that you're aware of, I would note that. If you notice different changes in your eating habits, so possibly overeating or eating less than usual, not feeling full, I would notice that over a course of two or more weeks at a time. If you find that other things, which we don't often hear about, but definitely happen to women, such as thinning hair, your hair falling out, or discoloration in your skin, or bags under your eyes, or feeling often very lethargic, even if you've had 6 to 8 hours of sleep a night, those would be more common signs of someone who really does need some type of change, whether it's to seek out exercise regimen or seek out a nutritionist visit or actually go further and talk to a mental health professional. Those would be some of the ways that I would say I'd recommend looking at getting professional help.
Wow. Asha, this is Patricia. I have two questions. Something you said that really I wanted to ask you. Do you find, you know, especially now, what is the age range that you're seeing most of people with mental illness? Mm-hmm.
Great question. So one, I see an increase, and I read a lot about the increases in adolescents in need of mental health treatment. So we're talking about tweens from 12 years of age to 19 years of age. In the African American and Latino community, we're seeing really startling statistics of Black boys, Black and brown boys, who are in need of mental health treatment from the ages of 13 to 19. So that is on the rise, as well as kids who are younger, so elementary school children who need special one-to-one services and sometimes supplementary care, such as mental health care or in-home care with their families. That's where I'm seeing a big change in the scope of work that's happening. In terms of people coming into private practice with me, millennials are definitely at the forefront of changing how people are actually looking at mental health, and they don't necessarily see it as a weakness, such as in older generations. They see it as of help that's necessary to seek out, and more as a self-development, almost like schooling. It's like a psychological, emotional education, as opposed to, oh, I'm not supposed to share my personal business with other people. They see it as, no, I'm stressed, I'm anxious, I'm working too much, I'm not happy in my life, I'm not finding a healthy partner, I think I need to talk to someone.
So my second question to that question, my son's a millennial. My two children are millennials. My son had, I think, two friends in the past maybe 5 years that have committed suicide. And it's so sad. It just breaks my heart, all of this. But one thing that I know that I've heard that, and you mentioned it, exercise. I heard that exercise helps a lot. I worked out at this gym one time, and there was a lady that was a bodybuilder, and I was body training. And she said bodybuilding saved her life. Mm-hmm. She said she was so depressed, and somebody told her that she should start lifting weights. And she started lifting weights, and her self-esteem got better, her mental psyche got better, everything about her. And she said she owes it all to lifting weights. Mm. And I know you said you also use that. The medicines that they give for mental illness, do you find that they help? Because I've heard stuff, and this could be wrong, and this is why I'm asking you this, that some of the antidepressants medicine that they give people, I've heard some people say that it makes you want to commit suicide.
Yeah, so let me speak to the first part and then the latter part. That's really great information to share. One, in the mental health community, I want to give us a lot of credit, because we do the work of the doctors that don't have the time to treat patients' mental health. Mm-hmm. We're unpaid for it and oftentimes under-recognized as to our contributions to the medical field. When we talk about the research out there now, there was a report that I saw just this past week of how medical practitioners are coming out of school undereducated in the contributions of diet to mental health. Mm. And so at the combination of diet and exercise, which we've heard doctors say before, oh, you know, get out and walk 30 minutes a day, 3 to 4 times a week. Okay, great. But also look at food and what is going into our bodies and how often we're hydrating and voiding, and how important is that to our health care. So when we think about the scope from early age schooling all the way through college, there are very few athletic programs nowadays. Kids don't have after school programs where they're physically active. They don't have gym where they're physically active. So you have a sedentary lifestyle that's impacting millions of people globally every single day, which now decreases people's proper immune system, that decreases people's ability to concentrate or think, because we know that people need to move their bodies. Now, when we fast forward to the second part of what you said, and we think about how many kids and then adults who are on antidepressants or anti-anxiety medications, we look at some of the signs and symptoms that are associated with that, but we don't look at the whole picture, the cultural impact, the environment, home and, you know, school or work, that contribute to people being restless, anxious, having lack of focus, short-term memory issues. And so when I think about why medications are prescribed, I tend to use it as a last resort for my clients who are not able to sleep at night, or are so on edge that they cannot focus or they cannot actually socialize, or people who cannot literally get out of bed to go to school or work in the morning. So when they're chronically ill, that's when I would go to, okay, let's talk to a psychiatrist or a psychiatric nurse practitioner and get you on a medication. And yes, there are antidepressants that have a black label, which gives those side effects associated with it, something as little as dry mouth or constipation, to even some of the medications actually increasing the likelihood of suicidality. This is why it's really critical when people are on medication, and this is where the responsibility of the patient comes in, as well as the doctor. It's important to, one, take medication as prescribed. I've been doing this for almost 20 years. The numbers of people who disclose to me that they do not take their medications as prescribed, I can't even count. They take it when they feel good. They take it when they don't feel good. They share it with their friends. They cut it in half. I mean, all kinds of reports that I get that are inconsistent with how it's supposed to be taken are risk factors in addition to the medication side effects. And if you also don't keep your appointments, which we encourage patients to do, then how can you know as a practitioner how effective or ineffective it is? Unless you see the patient regularly, you're communicating, you know, with your patients are being honest with you. And that takes, one, a relationship built with trust, which a lot of people, if they're going to their doctor, may not have that. And two, being able to have resources in place so that if the doctor can't see you, you can hopefully be in touch with the doctor's nurse or the doctor's admin assistant to say, okay, this patient hasn't been in the office for the past month. What's going on? Contact them, get them in here, find out what's happening with their medication. So there's so much that goes into it. It's not only one thing happened as opposed to another that would lead someone to have more suicidal thinking.
Wow. Yeah. You know, were you going to say something else? I'm sorry.
No, I just wanted to clarify, you know, if that was something that was answering your question.
You know, it's so interesting. Diana and I are very much into health and wellness. You know, we get, before we start doing anything, we get on our conference calls, we are dealing with our clients, we always talk about what we've done as far as our eating habits and our, you know, what kind of exercise we got for the day. And it's just interesting that if you look at all the diseases that are out there, the main thing that people really need to pay attention to is how they eat and how much exercise they get.
Well, sometimes we also underestimate the importance of rest.
Yes.
And just before this call, I literally had to give myself 2 hours of restorative time. That's for my body to regenerate so that I could feel physically well, to get up and be active, to where I could get vitamin D and I directly sat in the sun, to where I could also reflect and be introspective about the things that I spoke with clients about, colleagues about in the past 24 hours, the things I have to do today. So even that, we're in a society that pushes us to go further and to do more and to accomplish more, that people also are underestimating how valuable restoration is and repair. And that is something that we do every day, every night, with adequate sleep, with time off from thinking, communicating, being on social media, watching the news. There's just time that your brain needs to actually repair itself. And that is with silence and being without gadgets and things that distract us.
Absolutely. So, Asha, how do we change this stigma about mental illness and also about getting help from professionals like you? You know, it can be difficult for some people to ask for help, especially for women. How do we make this easier?
And if, I want to clarify that. Is the we in terms of society, a specific community? I just want to understand that better.
So we as a society, we as a community, because, you know, different communities, they have the same thing. So, you know, the same stigma. So, just abroad, we as a society, how do we change the stigma? You know, people just thinking that, oh, mental illness is a problem.
It's a great question. I want to go back to children. I think, and I don't work with children on a regular basis anymore. I have one adolescent client, but I used to do a lot of work with children and families, and I lean on children to teach us, the adults, what we need, because they don't have those restrictions that we create on ourselves over the course of time. They don't have those barriers to what they want to say or how they feel. They just express. And it's very liberating. And so I want to applaud New York and Virginia for being the first two states that have started to implement mental health education into the public school systems from K through 12.
I love it.
Yeah, me too. And so that's prayerfully going to change a lot of things about how kids come home talking to their families about feelings, what they feel they are experiencing in their bodies, what they heard today and what they thought about that. And that, I'm hoping, is going to open up more critical thinking. So that can definitely change it. And one, for if you're speaking to the Black and Brown communities, how it can change things is continuing to use media, which is one of the most effective tools these days to get any information out, whether you want to sell propaganda or you want to educate people, to normalize it as much as possible and make it incorporative with it being a medical, biochemical illness, so that people are not feeling ashamed that it is a character flaw, that it is a cultural weakness, that it's a gender-oriented disease, that people feel like this is something that environmentally or through heredity they have acquired, and that there's treatment for it. Some is preventative, some of it is through the education and the understanding of what it is and how we talk about it so that people can understand the signs and symptoms. Some of it is that we can do things to continue to prevent further decline if we're already diagnosed with an illness. And some of it is preventable, like you mentioned with exercise, and I mentioned with rest, and also you mentioned with diet. So these are different things that can normalize it. And also having people like us talk about it in everyday language. I don't whisper when I talk about having seen a therapist or going to my therapist. Most people don't want to talk about it in public. They're ashamed. Make it normal conversation. When you're going out with your girlfriends over cocktails, if you came into the bar late, say, oh, well, girl, I just finished seeing my therapist. I'm sorry, I'm running a little bit late. Or I have to leave early from this job today because I have to go see my therapist. That's what my white colleagues used to do.
Mm-hmm. To make
dialogue.
So I have, my family has a history of, you know, going through certain things, and they didn't identify it as like a mental illness. But, you know, as I got older, I read and I educated myself. So I saw certain tendencies that can relate to certain, mental issues, and you know, we all overcame them without going through, to a therapist. But I do feel like it's important, as you were saying, Asha, to have, number one, a holistic approach to, this whole thing, and also to include it in your, like, that's why we're having this discussion on your Wealth Mastermind, is to really include it into your holistic approach of your mindset. What is a great, healthy, abundant mindset? So I do find, though, you know, that from my experience, it's harder for women of color to ask for help when they need it. And I'm just wondering, you know, what are your thoughts about that, and how maybe that's something we can overcome? You know, this is sort of like a I don't want her to know my business, you know, kind of thing, where rather than that, you know, we're encouraging women of color, even through this conversation, to really reach out rather than hold this in. And so what are your thoughts about that?
Well, thank you first and foremost for having this platform to talk about it, because I would go back to something I said earlier regarding demographic. If I think of a time in history when women of color did not seek out professional help, meaning anyone outside of their community, so their home, their church family, maybe even if they had a relationship with their nurse or doctor, then in probably the past, I would say 15 years, that slowly, very slowly started to change with the evolution of this, quote, millennial generation that has coming out of, you know, high school and being educated possibly about mental health, seeing it in movies and television shows, having friends who have probably been in therapy. By the time they get to their adulthood, they don't see it as something abnormal or something shameful. But in prior generations, it's definitely something that has been mystified, where it's associated with weakness. It's associated with a certain class of people, a certain race of people, a certain socioeconomic background. So when we look at, you know, Black and brown women thinking of themselves as weakened by environmental factors, not weak even, but just stressed. That's something for a lot of us, we think is a cultural norm. And we associate it with a badge of honor. We'll say something like, you know, if my ancestors went through slavery and they endured that, I can definitely endure the stress that I'm going through in my relationship or with this job or with these children. Or if we think about the communities in which we tend to normally go to, our priest, our pastor, our imam, we'll say, okay, that's the gist of how far I'll go with talking to someone outside of my family, or holding it inside. So I would say, continue to look towards the younger generation for how we do this. They're breaking down barriers to getting into treatment. 98% of my practice is made up of millennials. More of my colleagues of color who I talk to on a regular basis are experiencing the same thing. 90%+ of their clientele are millennials. Young people are willing to pay out of pocket, mind you. They're not using their insurance. They're saying, I'll pay your fee. That's how much they value this. Now, what happens occasionally is because most of them are in treatment for the first time, just as anyone else who might be experiencing a crisis or just dealing with regular life stress, they don't know the parameters, they don't know the way it would help them best get the benefit of it. So that means sometimes you'll have people start treatment and fall out of treatment. You'll have people who come in and out of therapy. They'll go for a few weeks or months until they don't feel the stress or the worry that they once had that led them to care, and then they'll fall out, and then when they're under stress again, they'll come back. And what we say to them is develop a consistency with it. That is one of the challenges with working with more millennials, is when I see my older clients, they have a certain internal structure that's built to being more disciplined because they probably have a longer work history. They've probably done other things for a longer period of time. So there's an innate sense of discipline that I find in the older generation that I don't find necessarily as often or as long-term with the younger generation. So, and that's in certain cases. So women of color, seeing someone who is of color helps. Having someone that they can relate to, they think, who will be able to understand them helps a lot. We do have people that call the office specifically asking for a practitioner of color. And so I think using media again, talking about it, making it normal, definitely changes the way that people are seeking out help and getting the help that they need.
Yeah. So, Asha, you know, I think, this is just me, Patricia, thinking, first of all, I think we should get rid of the word mental illness. I think maybe, you know, if you look at it and you think about it, we all then have mental illness because we've all gone through depression. We've all gone through, you know, divorce and heartache. You know, maybe we could call it something like life's challenges or something. But the one thing that I notice that being a woman and going through a divorce, you know, people, and when we talk about the stigma, from the outside looking in, everything seems perfect. You know, you think this person is living this perfect life, but on the inside, the woman is really crying out for help. How do we get over that being perfect syndrome where people realize that they don't have to be perfect? And again, for me, the whole, you know, putting labels, I cannot stand labels. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe it's time for people, this is a newer generation that we're dealing with, maybe it's time to get rid of that mental illness name.
That's something that came up in a conversation a few weeks ago with a colleague of mine. He's in private practice, and he said the same thing to me, and I was taking it in, and I was listening, and I wondered, and to some degree, I agreed, but here's where I disagree.
Okay.
The reason that mental illness can be called what it is that there's so many diagnoses in our diagnostic manual, the DSM-5, that it really clusters so many disorders. And everything, this is where our society has not done a great job of this, or has aided in people thinking that almost anything is an illness. That's not the truth.
Mm.
Someone going through a divorce like yourself, or someone having experienced bad day, or being sad, even associated with something that is deserving of feeling those sad feelings, such as any kind of loss or disappointment, is not illness. It's illness when it becomes impacted by your functioning.
Deeper than that, yes, okay.
So because the brain, which we don't see, is more fragile than we know, it's so critically wired in a way that if we don't treat it properly through rest, exercise, hydration, sunlight, social relationships that are healthy and healing, then what can happen is the brain can then regenerate or degenerate itself, and it can separate from certain parts of your cognitive functioning to where now you might not eat properly. You might eat out of habit. You might eat out of unconscious depressive mood. You mm-hmm. might eat out of anxious thoughts that are racing that you think with food will calm you down. You might do things like not bathe every day, or brush your hair, or wash your hair, or brush your teeth. You might not get up and go to work or go to school. And those are things that what you're not seeing in your brain is contributing to what's happening, and the things you can see, which are your behaviors. And so mm-hmm. that's why it becomes illness, and that is over a course of time.
Mm-hmm.
So when we look at, if we call what people are living with the disorders that they are, trauma or a mood disorder such as bipolar disorder, which is chronic, or things that we know and we can point to that have diagnostic criteria that meet what people are experiencing, then we understand this might be what explains certain odd behaviors or things that are unusual or non-adaptive. So then that can some ways destigmatize people when they know what to call what's happening through them. And that's where we want to remove the shame. It's not your fault that you might be dealing with an illness. Everyone has health, mental health. Not everyone has a mental illness.
Mm.
So I think that's where definitely, you know, the language has to be put in place, and we have to correct people when folks in jargon say, oh, she or he has bipolar, simply because someone might be experiencing different points of variances in their mood. That doesn't make someone actually have bipolar disorder. It means that they're human, they're complex, they're experiencing life, which means it comes along with different states of mind and different feelings associated with that. And if we make that more common and understand that this is what humanity is, then we remove these labels, as you mentioned, from people feeling as if they're being diagnosed constantly or assessed to be treated with an illness. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
I do think, this is Diana, do you think that is the, I mean, I'm just thinking of Robin Williams and Kate Spade and, you know, the other guy, Anthony Bourdain, in terms of, you know, they had this life they were living, you know what I mean? That I mean, Kate Spade was an amazing designer. Who knew, right? Robin Williams, they were just, I think people are still kind of in shock about him. And then, you know, Anthony, they all just had, like, okay, seemingly this beautiful life on the outside, but then inside they were just so unhappy. And in my mind, it was just like saying, I don't know, maybe they reached out, or was it, you know, they went to a very dark place, or they didn't want people to know while they were alive that they had this kind of illness. I don't know. It's like, you know, really, it's still mind-boggling that they couldn't get the treatment they needed to sustain themselves, you know, because they were amazing three amazing people. So I don't, I mean, think of what you're saying is like, I think the purpose of this whole, you know, podcast is for anyone listening is like when you feel that you need to get help, call Asha. You really don't wait, like really call. And I just want to mention that, you know, Patricia and I are partners and, you know, so we do support one another. I mean, when I'm going off, she calms me down or, you know, she says, Diane, okay, get it together. You know, some way she'll tell me and vice versa, you know. And I think that has helped us in terms of those moments when we do go dark, you know. It's like she's there and I'm there. But if you're a solopreneur and you're dealing with all these different things, like taking on the world, like, you know, Wonder Woman, and you can't feel alone and not supported. And so do you have any tips on how to overcome this or what they can do, you know, to really make it easier?
Yes, and I will be really quick with this. First of all, both of you are just really dynamic in the fact that you bring up something that is very important to me, and that's community. That's what you're speaking of. Supporting each other is being a part of a community, whether it's professional community, whether it's a sisterhood, and that's what's really missing. We're in a time that our environment is not set up to have community, and I notice from people being in my office how desperately they're seeking that. What becomes problematic is how do you define a community these days and how do you speak it out when so many people need so much? They need to be valued. They need to feel wanted. They want to feel acknowledged, whether it's in their work or their home life or their community in which they're part of. So for solopreneurs, it's the same thing. We are working in isolation. I'm a solopreneur. We're working in isolation. I, you know, have people that work alongside me in terms of interns and contractors, and I also reach out to my colleagues who are practitioners in private practice. But one of the things I would say is it's important to be introspective and do that daily. Make time for it. If you have to put it in your calendar, and most people have their phone with them every day, put it in your phone. Make it an appointment. Okay, at this time, I'm shutting off social media. At this hour, I'm going to lunch. At this point of the night, I'm not talking to people on the phone. I'm not texting. I'm just literally going to sit for 30 minutes or an hour and reflect on the day, how I felt, what I noticed, who I spoke to, how I spoke to them, how I felt about those interactions. That is so helpful to being able to stabilize your mind from having so much on it and calming your thoughts and going back into your day and playing it back like a movie. So being introspective is one. Some people like to record those introspections. So I also encourage my clients, whether I'm coaching them or in private practice with therapy clients, to write it down. We have so many thoughts in the course of our day and we jumble them when we don't get them out of our brain onto something concrete. So some people like to journal. I'll encourage people to put a notebook next to their bed so when they wake up, if they have a lot of thoughts in the morning, jot them down. They do not have to make sense. They can simply be associations. Whatever you thought of, a dream that came up, something that you missed, one thing you want to do, write it down. Another way people record is I have clients that take my advice in taking voice messages and recording voice notes or putting a note in their phone. And that's been super helpful when it comes to clients who have dysregulated moods. So instead of doing something impulsive, they'll put a voice message on their phone. And then before they actually go into enacting something, they'll play it back and see, do I want to actually send this message? Do I want to talk to this person about this thing? So those are some very simple at your fingertip concrete steps. Also, seek out entrepreneurs, and it doesn't have to be in your industry. I know I mentored someone once who was seeking out professional mentoring, and they wanted people who were specific to their industry and were having such a difficult time because it was such a niche industry. And I said, you don't necessarily only have to look for those kinds of mentors. Look for people who are entrepreneurs, because what's typical is that entrepreneurs have certain things that they all do, right? And you probably know this too, is there's certain times a day you have to make phone calls, set appointments for your clients, schedule meetings. There are different things that we all do if we're successful or want to be that regardless of your industry, you're going to do. So seek them out. Use social media. LinkedIn is a great place to start and reach out, send an email, introduce yourself, and be specific about what you're looking for, how long you're looking for that, and why you need that now.
Awesome.
Wow. You know, it's interesting to me, and I'll make this really quick. Mental illness really has no face.
No, it doesn't.
And so, you know, you can look at somebody and have no clue what's going on inside them. And I remember there's one time my son told me, he goes, Mom, everybody has a story. And he always says that, and he's right. Everybody has a story, so you just never know. I guess the best thing that we can do as human beings is just treat everybody with love and, you know, and just continue to just be there for our friends and our family. And I don't know. I think that's, I don't know.
One question I'd like to state, if it's okay.
Sure.
To leave you with is, everyone is dealing with so many things. We don't know. Going back to your earlier vignette of the perfect woman and how it looks on the outside, and absolutely a lot of people are living this false identity.
Yes.
What goes missing is just in the people that you named earlier, and this happened in the Black community with the gentleman Chris Lighty, who people are still believing did not commit suicide, or even the gentleman who, his name escapes me right now, but he was the host of Soul Train. What is his name?
Don Cornelius.
Remember, he also died in a very suspicious way. Donnie Hathaway had schizophrenia. I mean,
I didn't know that.
Yeah, Donnie Hathaway had schizophrenia, and he died by jumping off of the roof of a hotel in New York City.
Oh, my God.
These things trace back in our own community, and it goes under the radar because we don't want to talk about it. We want to whisper it. We don't want to share. I had a conversation with Donnie Hathaway's wife, and I saw her on a program before we actually talked about this, and she was very upfront with her husband having schizophrenia and how many different ways she saw it come out, and people who worked with him and saw that. So there are these legacies that people want to make legends out of so that people think it's a mystery how they ended up deceased at a certain age or a certain time in their lives. He was in his 30s when he died. Don Cornelius wasn't an old man when he died. So these different things are things that we need to talk about. One of the ways that we can help people with all of the things that we do have going on and not knowing what people are dealing with is building a community and starting with asking the question, how can I support you? That's basic question. Yes. And doing it when you have the capacity to literally listen.
Yes.
You know, don't do it when you're on the go. Don't do it when you're running between meetings or you're on a flight somewhere. Do it when you literally, even if you have to send a preliminary text and say, I'm thinking of you, let's check in when I get back. And then follow up with your friend, follow up with your neighbor, follow up with your sister, follow up with your coworker, and put the time in and be willing to sit and listen and say, how can I support you? And that opens up a window of, one, being somewhat in communion with another person, being vulnerable, and also showing that you care so that you don't have to go into an enactment trying to solve everyone's problems. That's too much to bear. But you can maybe be that person to one or two people every now and again and open up a path for them to think about how they can empower themselves to help themselves. And it might just be you listening to them. It might be you giving them a number to a provider. It might mean you going to the gym with them. It might mean you taking a girls trip with them. It might mean you referring a mentor. It could be so many ways that you can help someone, and it doesn't mean you solving their problems for them.
Oh, Ash, I really love that you said when you have time to listen, because that means turning off your phone and really listening. I love that, because we sometimes act like we're listening, but then the phone rings and we get involved in that phone conversation. So definitely when we have time to listen, I love that.
Yeah. Thank you.
Anyway, well, Asha, we had a great conversation. I actually think we could probably talk for hours about this topic. But
absolutely.
I really want to say you are just awesome. I mean, I'm so glad that you had time, you know, to come on and talk and share with us. And, you know, we are actually going to start a community. We're going to start a Facebook group so that people can connect with the people we have on the show, and if they want to ask more questions, there's a way that will allow that to happen, so that we can continue this not just on the podcast but also on, you know, in a Facebook group so that people can reach out. So I think you're amazing. You know, you're awesome. And I truly, I know Patricia did too. I got a lot out of it today, you know, in terms of what we need to do. I know one thing I'm going to do is hydrate more. I drink water, but I didn't know I was supposed to hydrate. I didn't know like the correlation between that and, you know, my overall being. So I'm going to really drink more water. But yeah, I think you did an amazing, you know, amazing job. And I think what you're doing is serving the world in a way that is so profoundly needed.
Yes, you are amazing. From the first moment we saw you on that panel, yes. We knew, God, she's awesome.
So much. So are you all.
Well, thank you. Thank you for being on our show, Asha.
Yes.
Thank you so much for having me. This is awesome.